Well, good Thursday morning to you, and welcome to Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thanks so much for joining us at the other end of the radio waves and the telephone line and or the other ways we have to communicate together electronically. Our phone number locally is 414-1234. If long distance, twixt you and us, it's 800-926-8809. Email perspectives at WFSU.org, or you can tweet us at WFSU Perspective. Now imagine something. There's so much hyperbolic rhetoric that's flying around now because we are in the middle of a political season and everything seems to be the worst anything that ever happened before, and then tomorrow it'll be something else and we move on. But think of this, if you would. An unhealthy condition that affects one out of every two Americans. Okay, one out of two. If not me, certainly you. A condition that costs the average person more than $2,000 a year on average and consumes nearly 90 cents out of every dollar we spend on health care. Now, if someone told you about this, you would think, and you certainly would be excused for this, you'd think this would cause a national uproar. It'd be on all the media. The talk shows would be going crazy. There would be emergency measures immediately proposed by the federal, state, and local governments to solve the problem post-haste, right? This would be a crisis of biblical proportions in the country. But the fact is, you probably haven't heard about this catastrophic situation, right? Have you heard anything in the past 24 hours on any media outlet? Probably not. Well, today on Perspectives, we'll be tackling the topic head-on, though. The topic is chronic disease. And here to talk about it and how it really impacts all of us. Let's go around the table and meet these folks, and then we have someone else we want you to interface with. First, Charlie Adams, Deputy Director of Big Bend Cares. Good to see you, Charlie.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Good to see you, too. Old friend of ours, Brenda Olson, Chief Mission Officer of the American Lung Association of the Southeast, now operating out of a brand new facility, your house, right, Brenda?
Absolutely. It's great to be here, Tom.
Okay. It's great to see you, too. And all the way from Tampa, Dr. Nicole Bixler, President of the Florida Osteopathic Medical Association. Thanks for joining us, Nicole.
Thank you very much.
And on the phone, meet Candace DeMatteis, Policy Chief for the Florida Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease. Thanks for joining us, Candace.
Thanks for having us, Tom.
Give us the 30,000-foot overview, if you would, to start us off here. I kind of read out some rather frightening statistics and informational tidbits that you had provided earlier before we got this underway. Is really chronic disease that pervasive and that bad?
It really is, and as you mentioned, it's disappointing that we don't hear more about it. I think we kind of fall into the trap of it's so common that you know, you miss the forest for the trees, I guess. But the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease Florida is a diverse coalition representing many of the organizations you have today and others who are working every day to, you know, fight chronic disease, to raise greater awareness about the problem. It's the number one cause of death, the number one cause of disability, and the major reason that we see rising healthcare costs across Florida and across the country.
I know, because we hear this all the time, and this was part of the discussion leading up to the adoption of the Affordable Care Act and all of the hoopla that has taken place, even in the wake of its passage, the fact that healthcare costs continue to rise in this country. We just heard this morning on NPR and other media that Aetna is backing off now from the state exchanges and is withdrawing, essentially, from the Obamacare scenario. And so these costs continue to rise, and the whole idea of your partnership is to try to at least mitigate that rise and hopefully even reverse it?
That's exactly right. By pointing out the problem, the core problem are these rising rates of often very preventable and treatable chronic diseases, that is the source of the challenge, if you will, and we really need to focus on that if we want to make a difference in the lives, everyday lives of Americans and in rising healthcare costs.
Let's go around the table and kind of get a feel for the various participants' areas of expertise when it comes to this thing. And Brenda Olson, I can start with you. Cardiopulmonary, lung disease, smoking, all these types of things. This is what you guys are focused on. And what does that have to do in playing into this whole situation of chronic disease?
Well, the American, the American Lung Association has been serving the public for over a century and fighting lung disease. And lung disease is the number three killer in this country. It kills one, it's responsible for one in six deaths. And so that, we're talking about COPD, asthma, lung cancer, and many other lung diseases that can be prevented. And so the American Lung Association not only works to fight for access for care and to for policies that will help prevent, we also work on different kinds of issues such as trying to get Medicaid to provide comprehensive smoking cessation coverage. We know what works, and we know that people will be able to quit. Tobacco use is the number one killer in this country. It's the number one preventable cause of death in this country, and we need to do a lot more in terms of prevention, and we need to do a lot more in terms of access to care so that people are getting the treatment that they need.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Nicole Bixler, as far as osteopathic types of things, we're talking what specifically, what type of maladies do you folks focus on?
Well, I am an osteopathic family physician, so in my office every day I deal with every single one of these chronic diseases. Certainly, probably the complexity of the multitude of diseases that many of patients have is really what makes it most difficult to treat this problem as a whole. As far as the osteopathic profession, certainly we have specialists in every variety of medicine you can think of, surgeons, pulmonologists, cardiologists, that take care of our patients throughout the state of Florida. And it really does need to be a multidisciplinary approach from all of the healthcare team to really head this problem on straight ahead. I think probably maybe a little bit biased because I am a family physician, but I certainly think that the primary care physicians and for those that take care of the front line of really seeing patients and going over all of these conditions are really the core of the team that really needs to educate and try to really stop these problems earlier so they can be more preventable, so they don't end up to our specialty partners needing the treatment for their cancer or their COPD or other factors.
So. And so many of these seem to be a factor, again, of advancing age. Now, we may not see the quantum jumps in longevity that perhaps we did 15, 20, 25 years ago, but people still are living longer, and many of these diseases are a factor of the aging process, and we're seeing more of them statistically now.
Absolutely, Tom. There is no doubt that medicine has a double-edged sword. We have a lot of great things that have increased longevity and people are living longer, but with that, there are still things that are going to eventually be the cause of the demise of health, and that really does fall into these hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, some of these things. Obviously, cancer prevalence certainly can rise throughout that time, so we are still fighting some of the genetics and time, despite the things that we know that we can do a much better job at trying to get patients to prevent on their own.
Okay. And Charlie Adams, for Big Bend Cares, HIV/AIDS has been the primary bailiwick for your folks. But you're now kind of transitioning the organization. You're taking a more holistic approach now, aren't you, to a degree?
Yeah. I think, you know, everything that affects our clients affects the general population. We just add an extra layer of concern with HIV and AIDS, and in true fashion, the public health crisis and HIV and AIDS, you know, just goes on the back of everything else that affects the poor and people who typically are exposed to all of these diseases, you know, who smoke too much or who are not taking care of themselves. You know, from every angle they're getting hit, and we need to make sure from our point of view that we're managing the ability to access, you know, these types of medications and awareness and education. And that's where the holistic approach comes in. It's you can't necessarily just be reactionary to HIV. You've got to get out there and get in front of it, because once you have it, it's too late for us to prevent it. And while we're doing that, we can also help everybody live a healthier life by just getting some information into segments of the population that don't typically have it.
Candace DeMatteis, I think that's something that I see as we go around the table here, that you can, and we'll get into certainly public policy, because that is a huge factor in trying to get a handle on this problem of chronic disease too. But in just about every instance that we have encountered so far in our discussion this morning, there is that element of the personal that's in there, that in most, if not, well, I can't say all, but most of these instances, people can actually do something to either head off the disease, to try to keep it under control. There's something we all can do even while we're waiting for maybe governmental officials to kick in with better policies, right?
That's absolutely right. That most of the decisions that we make every day that affect our health take place outside the medical system. But to Brenda's point earlier, access is important, and there is an important role for public policy to facilitate access, whether it's for smoking cessation or education to prevent smoking from starting, if it's dietary, if it's promoting physical activity. Making the healthy choice the easy choice is a term we, you know, a phrase we hear battered about, but it's absolutely true that we need to make it easier for people to stay healthier, and there's multiple facets to that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of organizations, I know just in our area here around Florida's capital city, that whether it's promoting healthier diet or less sedentary lifestyles, all of those kinds of things that play into this, there's a lot of resources that are available in the community, and that's something else that we can talk about as we continue this discussion on chronic disease. And we want to hear from you when it comes to the discussion of chronic disease, maybe some experiences you've had yourself or family members, people that you know, and how that has played into their quality of life and the ability to live a more pain and stress-free life, as it were. And that's why we invite you to always be a part of Perspectives at 414-1234, the local number, 800-926-8809. If long distance from you to Florida's capital city, and our email address is perspectives@wfsu.org. A quick programming note as well, you can always catch Perspectives online because we put it on wfsu.org, usually within a couple hours after the program is broadcast. Click on radio when you go to our website, pull down the programs menu, click Perspectives, and you'll have the show there to listen to whenever you want, along with some nice pictures of the folks who have been featured in the program. We'll be right back in a moment. Talking about chronic diseases and the impact on our health and the health of the healthcare system here on Perspectives with our guest, Dr. Nicole Bixler, president of the Florida Osteopathic Medical Association, Brenda Olson, chief mission officer of the American Lung Association of the Southeast, Charlie Adams, deputy director of Big Bend Cares, and Candace DeMatteis, policy chief for the Florida Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease. We were talking about before the break the ability of individuals to take at least some control over the chronic disease trajectory, if you will, to get either ahead of it or to deal with it once these things kick in. Brenda Olson, talk about some of the things that you offer through the American Lung Association to help people if they say, hey, this is at least something I can do.
Sure. One of the overarching programs that we have available to anybody is our Lung Helpline. The Lung Helpline is staffed by registered nurses and respiratory therapists, smoking cessation specialist. And anybody can call in there and get information, no matter what disease it is. They can also connect you to your local office so that you can – there's resources there that are available. And that helpline is accessed by calling 1-800-LUNG-USA. Of course, the American Lung Association covers a myriad of different diseases and programs. One of the things that we believe very strongly in is education. We have a number of programs that are available for asthma education. We're really concerned about kids who have asthma that aren't managing their asthma as well as they should. And so we have programs for the schools to teach the kids, you know, their triggers, how to recognize impending problems, what kind of medications they're taking, how to take them properly. We know that if we educate the kids who also then take that education back to the home, these kids are going to be managed better. Asthma is the leading cause of absenteeism from school, from chronic disease. And so that not only impacts the kids and their learning, it impacts the parents too, because somebody has to stay home with those children while they're dealing with their illness. So it's really important that we also look at cessation, you know, tobacco cessation. I mentioned it before about it being the leading cause of – a preventable cause of illness in our country. And the American Lung Association offers a suite of programs called Freedom from Smoking. You can call our helpline and participate in it. There's an online program. We have in-person programs. We have self-help programs. And all of that can be accessed through our lung helpline, 1-800-LUNG-USA.
Okay, Dr. Bixler, some of the programs that kind of stick out in your mind that, oh, these are things that people could avail themselves of depending on what their chronic situation might be.
Well, I think as a whole, as a physician, and this general theme is educating and getting the information to patients. And I think one of the roles that doctors, osteopathic doctors, all of us serve is that we are usually that interface to get those resources to our patients. And that's the onus on us to have the time to do that and to be informed ourselves. So I think maybe not so much of a exact organization, but our partnerships with multiple other organizations, such as this one, is what's really important for the medical associations and practicing physicians to be availed of those resources to pass those on to our patients. I think that's a real disconnect sometimes that we have in medicine. And then certainly, again, as being on the front lines of taking care of it every day, is that it does require time. It does require time to discuss these things with patients. And that has somewhat been missing from healthcare, I think, as far as, unfortunately, the model of healthcare is with payments and all of those things, that's not really something that a physician is reimbursed for, is time that it takes to actually teach and educate a patient, and it probably is what's been missing. And so it is encouraging, regardless of other policies that we may talk about, that there is the pendulum coming back to more of what we call value-based medicine and care of chronic disease and more emphasis on the primary care physicians, who do tend to take that time to really expand upon all these chronic diseases and look into the socioeconomic factors of their patient, the social risks that patient has, the finances, all of those other factors that really often are what does not allow a patient to be in a good position to sometimes prevent these chronic diseases, whether it's they can't afford proper nutrition, they're in an environment such as Brenda mentioned, children in homes with smokers. I mean, that's not their fault, but that's the environment they're in. And so all those things take time to glean that from a patient to be able to hook them up with the right resources. So I think that's something as the overarching medical professions we need to continue fighting for, is showing that there is that value, and that is that part of medicine is what will eventually reduce healthcare costs.
I'm thinking of a young lady. In fact, she was in the first graduating class of the local Florida State University College of Medicine. And she graduated with a dream, and that dream was, strangely enough, to be an old-fashioned country family doc, like something out of the Waltons. This was her dream. She came from a rural background, and she wanted to give back to those areas. Sadly, she could not realize that dream because of the economic realities she was facing with the student loans and everything else. She finally wound up affiliating with a corporation to become a doc in a box, if you will. I don't mean to be pejorative, but it broke her heart because she really wanted to be that family kind of physician, that primary care doctor you're talking about there. Or is there any way we can kind of move back in that direction, do you think?
Well, I think there are factors that aren't going to allow that 100%. But like I said, certainly on a national level and some of the things that are there, there is the recognition that fee-for-service medicine and paying for procedures and paying for tests, which is really the economy of what it is now in healthcare, is not really what is going to actually make our patients healthier and does not reduce healthcare costs. What has to be is there has to be a full model of looking at all of it to take it into place, not duplicating efforts, not overutilization of certain things, but getting back to the basics, getting back to, right, sitting and talking to your patient and finding out what's going on in your home that's not allowing you to get your sugar under control, what's going on in your home that's making you have depression, which then we also know leads to so many other chronic diseases. And if you don't have that time or have that model of medicine that actually values that or rewards that for physicians, it's really kind of a very difficult situation to, as you pointed out, in today's world of medicine, for physicians to kind of come out and be able to do that with the economics of paying loans and everything else that goes along with being in medicine. So I wish there was. It's kind of the model that I try to practice as much as possible in my practice, but it's not always easy to do it. So it takes time.
Yeah, I understand. Charlie Adams of Big Bend Cares, a huge community outreach and education component that you guys have, right?
Well, that's, you know, for HIV and AIDS specifically, there is no greater way to fight the disease than education through communication with county and state Department of Health officials, to making sure everybody's on the same page with, you know, neighborhood medical or bond. You know, everyone has to kind of row in the same direction. Otherwise, you're going to be counterproductive there. Testing is a huge part of it. If you don't know you have HIV, you're certainly not going to be as likely to, you know, actively prevent the spread of the disease. And then, it really just comes down to simple things like, when we pass out condoms like crazy, and that is really, you know, and then on top of that, teaching people how to use them, when to use them, you know, all of that. We have a very gifted education department who can give the birds and the bees speech and conversation better than anyone I've ever heard, and it has an impact. I mean, you have to kind of scare people, especially young people, into believing that they're not invincible and that they can get these diseases. And although HIV and AIDS specifically doesn't have the same, you know, death sentence attached to it that it might have, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you still don't want it. And, you know, and if you're exposing yourself to HIV and AIDS, you're probably also exposing yourself to other things that you don't want either. So that part of what we do at Big Bend Cares, you know, that it's kind of the irony of we're trying to put ourselves out of business by eliminating the disease that we manage. That's it. I mean, there's no greater way to fight HIV than to get out there and get on the ground and take care of people that way.
Candace DeMatteis, I think everyone around the table has intimated that one other factor that we haven't really got into is, and someone mentioned depression. We have that. We have substance abuse, whether alcohol abuse or opioid addiction or those sorts of things. Those are also chronic diseases of a sort that need addressing, right?
Absolutely. And those behavioral and mental health factors can really exacerbate other conditions. It can lead to other conditions because if you're dealing with, for example, severe depression or severe mental illness, you're not necessarily taking care of your health as a whole. But also, if you have a comorbid condition like diabetes or heart disease, it can make those conditions much worse because, again, you're challenged with maybe an addiction or a serious mental illness. It makes it hard to, you know, seek regular care and take care of yourself like you should. So it definitely increases the burden on the patient and overall costs as well. So it's important to treat the whole patient and look at those behavioral and mental health factors as well as the physical health.
Well, the first half of the program, we've kind of focused on the personal responsibility mantra that everyone is so interested in when it comes to any kind of societal problem here. But now let's get more into the public policy area. And Candace, if we can stay with you for just a moment here on the national level, since There are some folks, I guess, who despair of ever getting much of anything positive out of Congress, at least under the current set of political circumstances. What could be done from a national and or state policy level to help with the mitigation of chronic disease when it comes to a factor in healthcare costs?
Sure. There are a lot of things that can be done. And again, we need to look at kind of the constellation of factors. The social determinants of health are important in factoring into long-term health outcomes. We talked about smoking. Obesity is also a growing problem amongst our young people and amongst adults. There is much that can be done at a state and local level to address the obesity crisis. And some of that, again, is facilitating physical activity, building it into the school day, building it into preschool and after-school programs, education about and access to healthier eating and opportunities there. But from a public policy perspective, the Affordable Care Act you mentioned, coverage was an important part, and that builds access. But it needs to be looked at more holistically if we're going to really make a dent in lowering tobacco use rates, particularly in underserved communities, excuse me, and lower income communities, and addressing those health disparities that really can make chronic disease disproportionately affect people with lower incomes, people with racial and ethnic minorities as well.
Does the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease have any preference as to what ultimately the healthcare situation in the U.S. should look like as far as coverage is concerned, like single payer or stick with the Obamacare / privately provided healthcare protocol? Or what are you guys looking at that you say, boy, if we had our druthers, this is the way we should go?
Well, the great thing about working with a coalition of diverse partners is that we don't always agree on everything. So it would depend really on who you were talking to within the partnership. But as a whole, we definitely support access to affordable coverage for all Americans. We don't go so far. Some in our group may want single payer. Others are much more geared toward a very private market, competition-driven model. But all of us can agree that we do believe that people should have access to affordable coverage, and that means access to care. Not, you know, we also talk about that just having coverage doesn't mean you necessarily have access to the care that you need. And we look at policies that address that as well and improve that access overall.
Okay, very good. Brenda Olson, since you, I know, have dealt with the legislature, I have seen you in those committee meetings, by gosh, but just last night, though, I saw a truth ad as I was watching TV, and that received some support from state government. There are other policies that you're looking at. What else could be done, particularly on state and local level, do you think, to help the situations that you deal with every day?
Oh, my goodness. There's so much that could be done. Where do I start? You know, Heather, you talked about value-based care. You know, one of the things that we're working on with our Medicaid office here in the state of Florida is to make sure that people who have have access to all the different medications that are available without barriers, so that you as a physician decides that a patient needs a certain medication, then that medication is covered through Medicaid. And speaking of Medicaid, we have a huge number of people in the state of Florida that's not covered by any kind of health care services. So they're too poor to buy into affordable health insurance, but they're not poor enough to be eligible for Medicaid. We've had a lot of effort trying to expand so that we can have more people covered by Medicaid so that they can get some of the basic services that they need. You know, when we start talking about tobacco, you know, there's more policy that could be done. One of the things that we've seen in other parts of the country, and there's new evidence to show that by raising the age to 21, that people can buy tobacco products, will have a significant decrease. And it's estimated that we'll see, you know, 12% decrease. That's a huge number of people that wouldn't – children who would never start smoking. And the reason the age of 21 is so important is it's harder for children to get older teenagers to buy the tobacco products for them. It's easier for the clerks to see that somebody's not old enough to buy tobacco products. The fake IDs don't work as well. And so the evidence is there. If we raise the age to buy tobacco products to 21, we're going to see a huge, huge decline in youth smoking. And we all know that if we can stop kids from smoking, that they're less likely to ever start. So it's so important for us to continue on policy areas to discourage children from smoking. We were talking a little bit earlier about whether or not tobacco is a chronic disease, and we were talking about how nicotine is a chronic relapsing condition that needs medical treatment. And even though it's recommended coverage in the Affordable Care Act, still people aren't getting the services that they need and the treatment that they need, whether it be pharmaceutical assistance, some medications, or behavior modification. We need to do a lot more in terms of making that sort of care available so that we can stop this tobacco addiction in its tracks.
And even though you mentioned that there are some folks who are not within the purview of Medicaid, it still sounds like you would be inclined for Medicaid expansion if ever the Florida legislature would decide. Maybe that's something we could talk about again.
Absolutely.
Okay, just want to get you on the record there.
Okay.
Dr. Nicole, from your angle, we have about 30 seconds here before a break, though, but talk about what you think from a policy viewpoint as osteopathic doctors and all that would you like to see?
I think briefly one of the things from our standpoint is making sure the access to care, as Candace pointed out, it's one thing to have coverage, but that doesn't mean you have access, and that is a big problem, and it's a growing problem. We don't have enough physicians to take care of the projected population. And so I think from a policy standpoint, one of our things from the Florida Osteopathic Medical Association certainly is making sure that we have a good policy for the state of Florida for our residency training programs and things to keep physicians who want to stay in the state of Florida to practice in the state of Florida to take care of the patients. Because without that, all of these programs are great, but again, if we're not getting that face-to-face time with those patients to educate them with the help of all of our other partners, it's not going to get us anywhere.
I know that it's always so kind of sad when you have match day over here at the School of Medicine and you have all of these bright young doctors who are headed out of state, and we have relatively few that stay here and do their residencies in state. Talking about chronic disease with an all-star panel here on Perspectives, give us a call, 414-1234 or 800-926-8809. Email perspectives at WFSU.org. We shall return. We're back on Perspectives talking about chronic disease and the partnership to fight chronic disease, not only on the national but also the state and the local angle. And going into the break, we were talking about the situation with residencies. And if you're not familiar, and I am not a doctor. I don't play one on the radio or TV or anything, but I have gone to some of these what they call match day events at the FSU College of Medicine, and that is where the freshly minted, bright-faced, cheerful young physicians are essentially given their walking papers to a residency slot somewhere. And some go to TMH and some go down to Sarasota, but a lot of them go out of state. And Charlie Adams, you were talking about that. What plays into where these folks go and whether or not they ever come back?
Well, ideally, if you're going to pull take the College of Medicine at Florida State, for example. They have a mission to create the doctors that Florida needs by pulling them from areas, even in some cases, you know, doing things academically to bring them along with their peers. Their school district may not have the science requirements that are, you know, someone from a private school or, you know, a more urban area has. So they're going to bring them along because the idea is that that young, you know, individual has a better chance of or a more likely chance of going back to the area they were pulled from. You know, the problem there is you cannot afford necessarily to do that. And so with the residency programs, a lot of times you'll see is if a young medical, recently minted doctor coming out of medical school, they would need to get a residency. That's part of their, career, as Dr. Bixler would say. I mean, it's essential. And so that's why the match day is such a big deal. If those spots aren't open in Florida, we're going to lose them to somebody else. And that is the ultimate problem is, 30 years ago, we didn't think we needed any more medical schools. So 20 years ago, we start creating, or 15 years ago, we start creating a bunch of medical, we start turning out doctors, but yet the lag now is in the residency slots because they just don't exist in Florida and nationally for that matter, but particularly in Florida with our population level and our need in the, with our senior citizen population. There's so many reasons why the state of Florida should be out in front of this issue instead of, trying to catch up. And there are people who are doing a great job of making, as many strides as possible. But it's not happening fast enough.
Okay, so it sounds like supply and demand, Candace Demetas, when you look at even medical personnel, and with the state growing as quickly as Florida's, we're back to what, in now taking in 1,000 additional people a day who are moving into our state. That also translates into higher health care costs, right?
It can, absolutely, if we're not, again, aligning those resources to address the problem. If we're just continuing to drive volume and waiting until someone is ill, that certainly is going to drive the need for services. But that's one of the reasons why we are so focused on, catching problems early, treating them aggressively to avoid those costly complications that really do absorb a lot of resources down the road, and certainly preventing them on the front end to prevent the development of chronic disease. But workforce issues are hugely a huge critical issue that we're going to have to address. And there are some innovative solutions, but again, we see those in pockets and not really a broader view that, Charlie and others were talking about, is that how do we address those needs? Is it through, looking at other healthcare providers and helping people practice at the top of their license? Is it, educating and empowering patients to do more on the self-management side? And probably the answer really is a blend of all, but we have to make sure those financial incentives that we really are investing in the education and providing opportunities for new doctors to come on board to focus on primary care to, enhance the nursing ranks of nurses and other clinicians as well.
Yeah, and exacerbating the whole situation is beyond the basic access equation that we have talked about a little bit here on the program so far today, is when you have underserved populations and situations in which an even higher incidence of chronic diseases because of income disparity and the lack of access again, and lack of prevention, all those sorts of things, too. We even had a story on today about a recommendation that mothers in some populations adopt something called a baby box, which I hear in Scandinavia is really, really popular. There's much infant mortality that is linked to mothers sleeping with infants in some, especially lower income African American communities in this area. And that is being now advocated as a possible way to help that type of situation as well, to get more moms to say, no, you're much safer over here than in bed with mom. And, how do you get that word out to those folks and make the cultural shift where that is going to be accepted and, oh, this is the way we do things now. So do you deal with those situations with a partnership too, Candace, or how do you address that, the folks who maybe be kind of are disconnected from more mainstream ways of education and information?
Absolutely. Maternal and child health is an important part of prevention, if you will, long term, and improving the health and educational outcomes, and again addressing some of those social determinants of health in these underserved communities. And that's where honestly Medicaid has a huge role to play. Some states will even have set up programs where people who are evaluated as being at high risk, perhaps they're a younger mother or low educational status, low health literacy, and having nurses do home visits and to address those issues. Maybe it's the sleeping with the baby. It might be environmental factors. Maybe there's a smoker in the household. educational needs, the importance of breastfeeding, things like that, that really can do one-on-one. And we talk a lot about patient education, but if you think about it, a lot of times, and I'm sure Nicole can attest to this as well, when someone learns they have been diagnosed with a chronic condition, their hearing shuts down. That's all they've heard. What are they going to digest at a teachable moment then to explain, okay, you have diabetes and that means you need to test your blood sugar 3 or 4 times a day and you're going to have to come in every 3 months. Are they even hearing that? So when a new mother is with her infant in the hospital and is overwhelmed with, you know, the emotions and the responsibility and the physical attributes, is that the teachable moment, or is it better to kind of have those follow up, those touch points over the, you know, first 3 to 6 months of the baby's life to make sure they're on the right path?
And Dr. Nicole, the consideration has also got to be, like you just said, do I, as a primary care physician, even have the time to sit down and say, now this is what it means, and here's what you need to do, and map all of that out with them?
In most primary care physicians' office, no, they don't, and certainly not in that one visit. I think it lends to what Candace said. It's a continuity of that care, and it really is a relationship build with a patient for them to often buy into what you're trying to teach them. There's many times I've treated a diabetic for 2-3 years and then still is like, all of a sudden, finally the light bulb goes off. Oh, you mean that's what I was doing wrong? And you're like, I'm pretty sure I've explained that at least 15 times, but the way you say it that one day, as she said, they might shut down, they're not processing, or again, it comes back to they just don't have the ability to really enact some of that education we're trying to give to them because of all those other social factors. And it is a time-consuming, but it's necessary. It's just really what has to happen in order to fight all of these chronic diseases, because that's really where it is. It's all the prevention part.
So. Well, and if we were talking here 80 years ago, we'd be talking about the scourge of polio or something like that, or whooping cough. Mm-hmm. And now we have therapies, we have medicines, we have things that have kind of pushed that into the background. So research and developing new treatments and medicines is going to be critical. Brenda Olson, what else we need? You're going to drop another $50 million on the CDC and say, hey, we can take care of a lot of these lung issues with that? Or what?
You know, you kind of read my mind, Tom. As we're talking, I'm thinking a lot of it does boil down to funding. For example, there's a CDC program for the different states for asthma. One of the things that Florida is doing, they have a pilot program where they are doing home visits and they're doing assessments to see what the environment is in terms of what's triggering the asthma and doing education in the home and working with the schools to make sure that there's proper education. But that all points back to, is there going to be funding in the future for those kinds of public health programs? And we continue to fight in D.C. to make sure that CDC is properly funded, that NIH is properly funded, because research is such a key. We haven't talked much about lung cancer, but there's very few tools to detect lung cancer early. And we know that we can save lives if we detect it early. And so that's why one of the reasons that research is so important, that we can find better tools to detect chronic diseases and better treatments so that people have a better quality of life.
Okay, Dr. Nicole, Blue Sky, what would you like to see go away besides everything?
Go away as far as chronic disease? I think it boils down to, when you look at a lot of this and as a physician treating disease, I think obviously the work that Brenda does, smoking and obesity, if we could take care of those two things, it pretty much wipes out a whole lot of the rest of chronic disease. So whatever approaches, tactics, and policies and coalitions we can to continue to fight those two things, it is a general basis. If we could do that, I think we could make huge, huge changes in the health of our people in the state of Florida and the nation.
Okay, Charlie Adams, your wish list there.
It's a long one, but I think ultimately you were talking earlier, Dr. Bixler, about the conversation and trying to have, you know, impart the wisdom that you have within a very short window, and it may take 12 times. I think one of the things that's worked really well with our organization is our peer program. We don't necessarily have the ability to put you in front of a doctor when you need to talk about something. And if you recently have a positive diagnosis and you're facing this, you know, emotions and stigmas and I can't tell my family and all this stuff, the best thing we can offer you is to talk to someone who's been through it and then even more directly relate it to how you got the disease. Did you get it from using needles, or did you have it male-to-male sex, or however you contracted the disease? We have someone available to talk to you and walk you through it until you get to your case manager or your physician. And there's a window there that's critical, and if you don't keep somebody involved and thinking and clearly about what they're about to do, you could lose them, and that just ends up being a disaster for everybody.
Okay. We have a caller. Jack is online, too. Let's add him to the discussion here in Perspectives. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much. As we know, a lot of our young people follow the path of the people who they live with, parents or other relatives. As a child advocate, I'm real concerned about the messages we send our kids when we smoke in cars, when we smoke in houses, and that's a question, I guess, for Brenda. And also nutritionally, we don't want to enforce nutritional practices, but there is such an intergenerational aspect to behavior that I was wondering how our public health leaders are addressing the in-home activities that parents are modeling, unfortunately sometimes negatively modeling for their kids. And I'll take it off the air.
Oh, thanks so much, Jack. It was great seeing you the other day. So, Brenda, that's it. The little eyes are watching no matter what you do, right?
Right, absolutely. And we know that parental smoking is a number one predictor about whether or not children smoke. And so part of what we do in the state of Florida is try to educate people about the hazards of secondhand smoke and how dangerous it is. Even being exposed to secondhand smoke introduces nicotine into these young respiratory systems, which makes it even easier for these kids to become addicted. But it's really we really need to do a lot more in terms of educating the parents. We've seen some movement from HUD. So that they are going to be adopting smoke-free facilities. All their housing will be smoke-free in about 18 months. So there has been some policy movement in that area. The best we can do is try to just really make sure that people are really doing everything that they can to protect their children from other people's smoke.
Yeah, Dr. Bixler might find this amusing, but one of the sources of secondhand smoke for me growing up was not only in my household, but also my doctor's office. Dr. Margaret Walters would give you your physical with a Lucky hanging out of her mouth. It was incredible. But nobody thought anything of it.
We didn't know any better then. A lot has changed. That, again, lends to all the research, development, treatments, education, and medicine is an evolving and always will be an evolving profession. And therefore, what we know today, even what we think we might be doing right today, we might realize 30, 40 years from now was not the right thing to do. But yes, you're right. Your doctors did used to smoke in the hospitals and the offices, and it's pretty astonishing to even think that at today's world.
I remember that ad, 7 out of 10 doctors prefer Camels. I thought, whoa. Candace DeMatteis, only a few moments left to go in today's program. If you'd like to, just from the viewpoint of the partnership here, where do we go from here?
Well, a lot of it is exactly what we're doing today, is raising awareness about the problem and also pointing out kind of where those gaps are. There is some low-hanging fruit, and we've talked about that some today in terms of we know what works. We know that smoking cessation works, for example, in tobacco use cessation, but it takes some people multiple attempts. So why are we putting up barriers to get that access that people need? The caller mentioned, the exposure of young people where they're mimicking their habits of older, the people they live with, the role models that they see. And that's an important reminder for parents. And I think that, activities like the Truth Campaign really do well. But I also think back of the educational system and the opportunities for health and physical education to teach kids and embody in them the importance of good health, the importance of physical activity, but unfortunately we're not making those investments. We don't have the school nurses in the schools like we used to. Once upon a time, we don't have the health programs and the access to physical activity and PE in the schools like we used to. So we need to, look back at, some of the things you talked about, the doctors in the old days who would do the rounds, the home visits. we're seeing a resurgence of that. Now, it may not be the doctors doing it. It may be a community, a trained community health worker. It may be a nurse a practitioner, a medical social worker. But we are seeing some resurgence of those things, of looking back at what works well. The biggest thing from our perspective is that's really happening in pockets. We need to do a much better job, and policymakers have an opportunity to highlight those successes, find out what works, and really replicate them. Align the resources, align the opportunity so that everyone can benefit.
Thank you. Final thoughts here, Charlie Adams.
I would just echo, you know, much of what Candace was just talking about. I mean, if you don't start early and deliver the message often, I mean, that's what advertisers do when they want your child to buy something on TV. We can do the same thing with this. We just have to be thorough, and it has to be it has to be paramount.
And Dr. Bixler, besides an additional 24 hours in a day for you to do what you do, what else would you like?
I think more, again, lending to the patients. I think establishing good relationships with a primary care doctor or physician is important. Not waiting until you get sick to then go seek help, but get there sooner and advocate for that is really one of the best things we can try to do from the patient side, for them also to be a part of this partnership in fighting chronic disease.
Thank you. And Brenda Olson.
And the last thing I'd like to add is it takes all of us. We all have to be involved. We have to be involved in our public policy issues. We have to be involved in education. And a partnership like this is really important so that we continue to make progress.
Thank you, Brenda Olson, Dr. Nicole Bixler, Charlie Adams, and, of course, Candace DeMatteis for a great discussion today on Perspectives. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox. Lido Rawls handling our communications interfaces over there. I'm Tom Flanagan. Next week, who takes over your business when you decide to move on, huh? Something business owners need to think about in advance, and we'll talk about it right here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcasts. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.